Welcome to the Geographical Podcast, brought to you by Geographical Magazine, the official publication of the Royal Geographical Society. I'm Jacob Dykes, journalist at Geographical.
And I'm Katie Burton, Geographical's editor.
Each month, we bring you the stories that matter. With writers from around the world, we help you to keep a global perspective. Published since 1935, Geographical has a rich heritage in monitoring and exploring our planet. Here you can listen to excerpts from our monthly print magazine, but for the full experience, subscribe to the magazine today through the link in the description. 2021, much like the bulk of 2020, has started with that familiar sense of uncertainty. Once again, many around the world are under enforced lockdowns, and as of January the 6th, England entered its toughest lockdown period since March. Confined to our homes in an effort to control the newly identified variant of SARS-CoV-2, the highly transmissible B117, the pandemic is truly testing the public's resilience. A vision of hope, however, rests on the shoulders of the vaccination effort. If things go well, said UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, the government expects to have the first dose to everyone in the top four priority categories by mid-February. The task of quickly designing and clinically testing COVID-19 vaccines has now given way to the formidable challenge of distributing them. The remarkable speed with which they were developed shows how quickly medical breakthroughs can take place when funds and resources are pooled. But many diseases don't receive such attention. Can COVID-19's legacy help to eliminate other, more neglected diseases? Or is the system broken at its very core? This month, Mark Rowe and Benjamin Hennig explore the subject in an extended dossier, narrated here by actor Simon Paisley Day.
Vaccines. We've never seen anything like it. COVID-19 only emerged in December 2019, but within months, the race for a vaccine already involved 150 candidates, and by November 2020, two vaccines had reported back showing around 90% efficacy against the virus. The World Health Organization, WHO, plans to vaccinate 2 billion people by the end of this year, 2021. Effective COVID-19 vaccines are crucial if millions of lives are to be saved and economies allowed to recover. These Herculean and fast-paced efforts contrast with the painstaking 30 years it took to develop an effective polio vaccine, or the 10 years to combat measles. A cynic might be forgiven for asking whether so much attention would be paid to COVID-19 were it not so easily transmitted and had travelled no further than China, rather than landing on the doorstep of Western nations. The same cynic might also politely inquire as to when such urgency will be devoted to the group of hideous illnesses that are collectively, and without irony, described as neglected diseases. A diverse group of communicable horrors, neglected diseases prevail in tropical and subtropical conditions in 149 countries, affect more than 1 billion people, and cost developing economies billions of dollars every year. The WHO lists 18 diseases it classifies in this way. The situation we see with diseases that are the scourge of humanity, such as leishmaniasis or sleeping sickness, is not comparable with COVID-19, says Dr. Marie-Paul Keeney, the head of the Board of Directors of the Drugs for Neglected Diseases Initiative, DNDI, a non-profit research and development organization. History tells us it's difficult to harness the same leverage for accelerating resources, she says. This is not something that happens with routine situations. What really generates goodwill and change is a sense of a crisis. According to DNDI, of the 1,556 new drugs approved between 1975 and 2004, only 21, 1.3%, were specifically developed for tropical diseases and tuberculosis, even though these diseases account for 11.4% of the global disease burden. The old diseases, such as leishmaniasis, will not attract more funding. They are centred in particular areas, they don't really move around the world, says Dr. Moga Kamalyani, a consultant on global health and universal access to medicines. These are diseases over there somewhere that we've judged will not affect us in the West. The only way it changes is if a disease jumps country. The political importance of a disease is usually translated into funding for that disease. The global reaction to Ebola in 2014 and SARS-CoV-1 in 2002 illustrate this. There was huge panic. The world was turned upside down, says Kamalyani. But once everyone realized that SARS was not going to infect the world, interest was lost in developing a vaccine. The same happened with the Zika virus in 2015, which flared up and made everyone worried. But it calmed down, so the West has deemed it not to be a threat to us. But it's a horrible disease. Another concern is that long-term research into vaccines for diseases that have a grinding effect on developing parts of the world also get sidelined during times such as these. COVID-19 had an immediate effect in that people who were working on other vaccine work had to stop because of lockdown, says Kamalyani. Then they were told they had to drop everything, put research on the back burner, and work on COVID instead, because that's where the funding was being diverted to. Diseases such as Chagas, which affect 7 million people every year, were already neglected before the pandemic. Now the diversion of resources to fight the pandemic strains on healthcare facilities and patient concerns about contracting COVID-19 when visiting clinics all put pressure on those suffering or dealing with Chagas and other neglected diseases. Such trends create ethical and medical implications. Many neglected diseases amount to comorbidities that make people vulnerable to COVID-19. Chagas, for example, causes cardiac, gastrointestinal, and other complications that could increase susceptibility to COVID-19. COVID-19 has unquestionably seen funds diverted. The WHO says that doctors and health workers across Asia and Southern Africa have had to reassign budgets and equipment to track COVID-19 infections rather than TB. Excess deaths from TB, which kills around 1.4 million in a typical year, may turn out to be as high as 400,000 in 2020, says the WHO. Bedaquiline, the first TB drug for 40 years, was only approved in 2012. The same concerns apply to the rollout of a COVID-19 vaccine. Dr. Hayley McGregor, a research fellow at the Institute of Development Studies at the University of Sussex, points out that people charged with delivering the vaccine are likely to also be responsible for administering the MMR vaccine to young children. That will require a bit of effort to strengthen systems to do both, she says. The choice of where investment goes has also appeared at times binary, McGregor adds. The question has been which diseases get prioritized and which ones get neglected. An obvious response is required to a disease such as COVID-19 that has a high mortality, but is that at the expense of other diseases with high morbidity? COVID-19 has forced that debate, but it shouldn't be a question of either or. More positively, the mobilization in response to COVID-19 could improve the ways in which vaccines for less heralded diseases eventually see the light of day. When you have such an unprecedented event, you get paradigm shifts on how things can be done, especially in relation to the sheer speed of biomedical research, says Andy Powery-Smith, Communications Director at the European Federation of Pharmaceutical Industries and Associations. The lessons learnt include an understanding of how improved data analytics technology can accelerate trial. Increased speed of regulatory approval and an ability to develop vaccines at scale could also be here to stay, he suggests. Rather than wait for the end of the entire process, you can have a more dynamic approach to presenting data. The regulatory rigor takes place as you move along the process, and that doesn't involve cutting corners. One of the most striking aspects about the COVID-19 research is the unprecedented alliance it has triggered of public, private, academic, and philanthropic sectors. Coalitions are not new, But the effort and funding has been to a different degree than with diseases such as dengue or the stuttering investment in the Zika virus, says McGregor. This is typified by the partnership that saw the first vaccine candidate over the line between Pfizer and BioNTech. The former is a pharmaceutical giant, the latter a medium-sized enterprise that received $400 million from the German government. The Oxford Jenner Institute's collaboration with AstraZeneca follows a similar model. COVID has seen hitherto unseen levels of collaboration. Look at the frontrunners for the vaccine. They were all smaller organizations or companies coupled with a larger player, says Powery Smith. The sum has been greater than the parts. Many people think COVID-19 research has only emerged in the past 6 months, but it is based on years of work. As Kamal Yani points out, the Oxford COVID vaccine didn't happen out of the blue. They had material and research drawn from years of work on SARS-1. The donkey work is done over the years before. The speeding up of data processing and trials may also incentivize pharmaceutical companies to back a wider range of vaccine research, says Powery Smith. Commercial arguments about the length of a process are something companies have to consider as part of their plans. Regulatory bodies such as the EMA in the EU and the FDA in the United States can take advantage of this. The sharing of information also offers lessons for the future, suggests Manuel Martin, Medical Innovation and Access Policy Advisor at Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF. China shared the COVID-19 genome very early on, which was extremely useful, but then companies all went off into their own silos. The question is whether companies that come up with COVID-19 and other vaccines are prepared to share how to produce their vaccine. So far, we haven't seen that. Yet others feel that a more fundamental shift is required, and that the business model that determines which vaccines get the green light for research and, above all, development, or manufacture and scaling up, has to be fundamentally reshaped. This is because of a simple reality. Most vaccines are manufactured by private companies. Generally, research for vaccines is funded by public money, either through universities or public institutions such as the US National Institute for Health. These are then picked up by pharmaceutical companies that make a judgment, to put it bluntly, they cherry-pick, on which medicines to develop and scale up. What we have really learned from COVID-19 is that the number one element is the importance of public money, says Kamal Yani. Vaccine development usually takes years, and that's mainly because researchers have to apply for grants and argue the case with donors. With COVID, money poured into R&D. The problem I have is how pharma companies that produce vaccines present themselves as saviors of the world when it's actually public money that supports the research. The companies then sell it back to us, so the public pay twice, which is outrageous. The funding models for COVID-19 vaccine research highlight, suggests Keeney, that most states have given up their sovereignty over R&D and passed it to the private sector. Governments are short-lived, saving money is what they want to do, their people move on. Research in pharmaceuticals is long-term. This means that public laboratories that do the research will then try to negotiate their innovation to private companies to do the development side. So will this prevailing model, which has traditionally driven the development of vaccines, leave hundreds of millions of people squeezed out of COVID-19 vaccine programs? It seems that those lower-income-funded nations, unable to pay the prices asked by vaccine producers, will be reliant on philanthropic organizations or purpose-built entities such as COVAX, which was set up by the WHO, Gavi, an initiative that also includes UNICEF, the World Bank, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, CEPI. COVAX is funding both R&D and negotiating pricing to ensure access for the poorest nations. With COVID, it looks like the COVAX program will be required to fill in the gaps and make sure poorer nations get the vaccine, but it shouldn't be like that, says Kamal Yani. It appears that there will be huge variations in what is defined as equitable distribution. Unsurprisingly, the West will be first in line for the jab. Gavi declined to be interviewed for this article, but acknowledges on its website that, subject to funding availability, funded countries will receive enough doses to vaccinate up to 20% of their population in the longer term. In the West, the proportion who are vaccinated is expected to be much higher, around 50%. Even under COVAX, not everyone who needs the vaccine will get it, says Kamal Yani. Martin describes this attitude as post-colonial and says, "The idea seems to be you can have some of the vaccine, but only after we've made sure all our people have got it. That needs to change." Yet, the only way to ensure the equitable distribution of a vaccine, says Kamal Yani, is to establish a system of open licenses. A pandemic is not the time for people to need to make a profit for the demand to be met, she says. It has to be a people's vaccine. There is a moral argument for it being free at the point of use, and that should be primary. That's also a practical argument, because if you really want to stop COVID in its tracks, you have to protect everyone. The producer of a vaccine can name a price a country has to pay for the vaccine, says Kamal Yani. Countries like India, Brazil, South Africa will be able to pay for it. But what about Sierra Leone or Mauritania? One way to change this model would be for nation-states to discover an enthusiasm for both research and development. Keeney sees merit in the EU establishing a production company to develop drugs for everything from frontline cancer treatment to neglected diseases. There is no doubt the state should be more invested in health for their own citizens, she says. It would be self-serving because you are helping people at home as well as abroad. We need to invest public money into the development of innovations made by the public sector and small biotech companies in order to ensure that the right treatments will be available at an affordable price. The realization of a need for state investment may see a ripple effect in drugs for neglected diseases, but whether that translates into real progress, we will have to wait and see. This approach could usefully apply to the continent of Africa too. Southern nation governments have to realize the importance of investing in R&D for vaccines, says Kamal Yani. Otherwise, as with COVID, they will be waiting for the North to realize that a disease might affect them too before they take it seriously. The North will develop a vaccine and name the price the South will have to pay to access it. Médecins Sans Frontières feels this is an important point. The ideal situation is that African R&D comes up with vaccines and production for diseases such as Ebola, not the West, agrees Martin. There are research hubs in Africa. Senegal has some diagnostics capability, the Pasteur Institute in Dakar, but it is still in its infancy. It will take time and a willingness on the part of the international community. Keeney reports that attempts at such a system have generally foundered across the continent. The scientific knowledge and expertise to set up something like this exists, so there's a valid argument for doing it. But one of the main issues is governance, which applies elsewhere, not just in Africa. Who will put money in? If nobody regulates the drugs produced, no one will buy and manufacture them. If you run these through charities or donors, then the money only goes so far. If the state will not invest, then everything just collapses. Martin also feels that a more equitable model is necessary, and that this should reflect everything from access to vaccines to transparency and cost. The sheer scale of voluntary action and public-spirited goodwill should also be taken into account, he says, pointing to the large number of citizens who offered to participate in trials for free and do so in the knowledge that if they are in the placebo half of a trial, their lives may be put at risk. I understand pharmaceutical companies need to make a profit, but the question is whether their expectations go well beyond what could be considered reasonable, he says. Clinical trials are expensive, which is why pharmaceutical companies are wary of conducting them. But so much public money and effort goes into the practicalities of rolling them out. That should mean greater transparency when it comes to what prices are paid, as well as a greater sharing of know-how. What's clear is how investment in vaccines saves money in the long term. John Hopkins University in Baltimore, in the United States, reports that for every $1 spent on immunization, $21 are saved in healthcare costs, lost wages, and lost productivity due to illness and death. When considering the value people place on lives saved by vaccines, which is likely to include the value of costs averted, plus the broader societal value of lives saved and people living longer and healthier lives, vaccines are probably the most health-effective intervention you can give, says Powery Smith. We spend trillions in building up the global economy, and a virus like COVID-19 takes it down in the space of 6 weeks. Globally, governments have spent around $96 trillion in response. For me, that focuses the mind on the absolute importance of biomedical research and expresses in an extreme way the links between health and the economy and the value vaccine delivery has to health and society. This goes way beyond industry. It's a societal issue. Yet vaccination is not the only way to benefit public health. A much wider question would consider why some vaccines are needed at all. A universal rule with diseases is that they disproportionately affect poorer communities. COVID-19 has shown that this applies in the high-income West as well as in developing nations. Populations living in poverty, without adequate sanitation, and in close contact with infectious vectors and domestic animals and livestock are those worst affected by the cohort of neglected diseases. The reality is that if people were less poor, then we wouldn't have these neglected diseases, says Keeney, who points to the example of cholera. Do you invest in a vaccine or in better public water supplies? Clearly, you need to do both. The question is whether you invest only in short-term fixes. For some diseases, it's prudent to consider other interventions, develop treatments, or invest in long-term measures to address poverty. This wider picture is recognized by MSF's Martin. COVID-19 is actually the latest in a long line in failures in public health. It seems that as a global community, we are not really interested in pandemic preparedness. Much of the COVID effort and R&D has been really good, and it's incredible to develop an efficacious vaccine basically within a year. But we could do with it in other areas. It would make a huge difference to so much public health in low-income countries. The most obvious risk in relation to a post-COVID-19 world is that once vaccines are rolled out, then the West will move on. Will people's memories really prove to be so embarrassingly short? It's a question that can draw a sigh out of experts in the field. Kamal Yani is particularly sceptical and feels that COVID-19 research reinforces rather than challenges the long-standing business model. Unfortunately, this will not change the way we think about neglected diseases, she says. With COVID, pharmaceutical companies got interested when they heard two things: that rich countries were committed to pour money into research and development, and that scientists said COVID wasn't going to go away, that it would need to be treated like flu, you'll need repeat vaccines. That makes for a business model that works for vaccine producers. Others recognize a natural human trait of relaxing as immediate danger passes, but suggest the extremes of COVID may have a different legacy. The first thing people want to do once a crisis is over is just forget about it, says Keeney. But there's a chance that things can change. On this at least, the pharma industry and NGOs are in agreement. At some point, we need to take a break and analyze how these new positive ways of working can be incorporated into what we do in the future, says Powery Smith. There is a collective responsibility to learn from this. Inevitably, some of these things will be forgotten, but there is a real willingness to learn how we can do things better. McGregor is optimistic that the impact of COVID-19 will prove visceral enough to change longer-term attitudes to public health. I would hope the lessons we learn involve some rethinking about preparedness and about rebalancing the system so that it can prepare for future epidemics as well as wider health system problems, she says. We need ways that incentivize R&D but do not necessarily rely on making a profit. That sounds horribly idealistic, but COVID has given high-income countries rather a jolt at how these things can happen. In Africa, I think the concept is still strong that sudden death from an infectious disease can happen. Dengue affects 60 million people every year, but there is no prospect of a treatment, Kamalyani points out. It's unlikely there'll be the financial incentive to produce a treatment. Attitudes towards malaria might just change if it takes hold in southern Spain and elsewhere with climate change. Martin has similar concerns but tries to be upbeat. We can't keep going with the duct tape approach to address market failures. My fear is that we will not learn from this pandemic and reevaluate. But if I wasn't optimistic, I wouldn't do this job. There are some silver linings in all of this.
This article, written by Mark Rowe and Benjamin Hennig, and narrated here by Simon Paisley Day, originally featured in the January print edition of Geographical. In the magazine, you'll find the best features and stories, stunning photography, along with smaller reads, book reviews, puzzles, and much more. Next up, we turn our attention to the Comoros Islands.
Geographical contributor Tommy Trenchard visited the Comoros Islands in 2018 and 2019. This small archipelago off the east coast of Mozambique dominates the world's supply of ylang ylang essential oil. Tommy wrote about the island, its farmers, and the volatile ylang ylang industry for the January issue of Geographical. Here he tells us a little more about his experience.
My name is Tommy Trenchard. I'm a writer and photographer based in Cape Town, South Africa. So ylang ylang is a flower. Its scientific name is Kananga odorata. It's indigenous to Southeast Asia, but it has it's been cultivated in the Indian Ocean for over 100 years. It's kind of a funny looking, like droopy yellow flower, not particularly attractive, but it has this incredible scent. For that reason, it's been in high demand from the luxury perfume market for a long time. And to get the scent, you need to distill it. Ideally, you need to distill it within hours of it being plucked from the tree in order to kind of retain most of its scent. And the product you get at the end of that distillation process is this incredibly amazing smelling essential oil, which is then exported almost all of it to France, where the world's sort of high-end perfume market is. The Comoros, I mean, incredibly, given that it's such a tiny, tiny place, I mean, you've got less than a million people living there and the land area is minuscule, but somehow it's come to completely dominate the kind of global supply of this oil, and in particular, the sort of high-end, the high quality oil that's used in the perfumes. You do get other sort of grades of ylang ylang oil that go into soap and sort of incense and things like that, but nowhere can quite match the Comoros for quality. Initially, I was looking into the deforestation angle, and it turned out that what I'd read in the press wasn't, it was a bit more complicated. Yes, the distilleries did burn a lot of wood, but most of it, the Comoros has seen like incredible deforestation in the last 50 years, and there's not a lot of indigenous forest left. So most of the wood that's getting burned comes from sort of planted agroforests, particularly mango. There is a strong link between deforestation and the ylang ylang, but mostly it's people clearing forest to plant food crops because so much of the island is now taken over by ylang ylang cash crops for export. I was sort of exploring that, but it quickly became apparent that that something pretty major was happening in the industry at the time. The farmers were over the moon because the price of their flowers and the oil had shot up over the previous 4 years at a completely crazy rate. I think it was at the time I first arrived in 2018, I think it was 25 times more valuable than it had been 4 years previously, roughly. So there was kind of a gold rush going on, and people were planting just thousands and thousands of trees, and it was really sort of a free-for-all. And that initially became the focus of my story. So the industry had been in decline for quite a long time. Just that it had been so riddled with problems that the perfume companies in France had been put off using Camorian oil. By problems, I mean sort of the opaque nature of the supply chain and the environmental issues and inconsistent oil quality. But then a few organizations had come in and sort of overhauled the sector, and it had completely transformed the way Ylang Ylang was perceived overseas. And so suddenly there was all this attention, all this money coming in, and people were sort of split. Some people were telling me that it was like the best thing that had happened in the Ylang Ylang sector in years, and others were worried even then that there was going to be there was going to be a huge crash, that the price was spiraling like out of control, and that it couldn't stay that high. By the time I went back the following year, things were sort of right on the edge. The price had become so high that the perfume companies in France could no longer really afford the Camorian oil. All these kind of middlemen had been jumping in and mixing it with things like brake fluid, which you'd think would be very easy to detect, but is actually quite tricky. And so you've got all this kind of tainted oil turning up in France, and it's way too expensive, and that demand is just beginning to dry up. And it wasn't long after that second trip that the bottom kind of fell out of the market and everything came crashing down. And so when I called back in the months that followed just to get updates, people were telling me that the flowers were just, there wasn't even any point in harvesting them on some farms anymore. They were just being left to die on the tree because it just cost more to hire the pickers than these farmers would get for their flowers or their oil. I think when there's a product that so many of us use on a day-to-day basis, and I think Chanel No. 5 is probably the most famous perfume there's ever been, and that one of the key ingredients of that is Ylang Ylang. So I thought that it might hold some interest for people who do have this sort of connection to the Comoros, even though they probably never realized it. It reflects a sort of wider problem within the aromatic crops market in general. A couple of years earlier, the same thing had happened with vanilla, which also happens to be an Indian Ocean crop, mostly produced in Madagascar. And at one point during the vanilla boom, it became worth more pound for pound than silver, which was a pretty crazy, a really crazy spike. And that kind of affected ice cream prices all over the world. And so I think the way these kind of obscure markets perform, it does does often kind of link back into us as readers, as consumers, wherever we happen to be in the world.
Issue of Geographical, and in the next edition of the podcast, we turn our attention to the Scottish Highlands. You may have already heard the name Paul Lister, painted by some media corners as the Wolfman of Scotland. But as we explore next month, Lister's plot to restore the degraded ecosystem at Allerdale Wilderness Reserve, north of Inverness, is rooted in more than divisive wolf reintroductions. In 2003, Lister launched a program to restore portions of the forest that would have once covered the highlands, replanting trees, reintroducing lost species, and restoring damaged carbon sinks. So far, more than 1 million trees have been planted. To protect tree saplings, Allerdale have high deer culling targets. Many see this controversial use of the human hand in nature as contradictory to the wilderness envisaged. But the team's philosophy stretches deep into the future. One day, they hope that the succession of species and vegetation could be unhurried by the human hand. Come back next week to hear more. Or for the full stories, subscribe to Geographical Magazine by visiting www.geographical.co.uk.